From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, I have the pleasure of reintroducing a guest host named Kim McQueen. Kim did a previous episode for Write the Book. She is faculty advisor to students in the professional writing, creative media, communications, and film programs at Champlain College. Kim is also managing editor for the Champlain College Publishing Initiative, and she serves as an adjunct instructor in the professional writing program. Kim McQueen has 25 years of experience in writing and editing, author of two novels, Out, Out, A Novel of Women and Apes, and People Who Hate America. She's currently a student at Bay Path University's MFA program in creative nonfiction. In 2017, she interviewed Shozan Jack Haubner on this show. This week, she speaks with the author Brad Warner, whose newest book is It Came From Beyond Zen, published by New World Library. Ordained as a Soto Zen priest, Brad Warner is also a punk bassist, filmmaker, and blogger. He's the founder of Angel City Zen Center in Los Angeles and the author of Hardcore Zen, Sit Down and Shut Up, and several other books about Zen Buddhism. His writing appears on suicidegirls.com and in Lion's Roar, Tricycle, Buddha Dharma, and Alternative Press. He lives in Los Angeles. And I hope that you enjoy his conversation with Kim McQueen.
So, Brad, you've written several books about Zen Buddhism, and I believe I've read most of them, and I've really enjoyed them. Your last two, though, have been a bit of a departure from what's come before. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what led up to the publication of Don't Be a Jerk and It Came From Beyond Zen and how they're different.
Well, I was in a comic book shop in Philadelphia and I came across this book called God is Disappointed in You. Actually, a friend of mine showed it to me. And it is a book in which somebody took, I forget the name of the author, but he took the entire Christian Bible and rewrote it in his own words. And this friend of mine who was looking at the book with me said, hey, you should do that with Dogen, you know, somebody who knew what I'd written. And I initially dismissed the idea. I thought, well, you can't do that with Dogen. He'd kind of turned the book, he turned the Bible into comedy, sort of, but it's pretty true to what the Bible actually says. And I thought, that can't be done. But I didn't really have any better ideas, and New World Library kind of was interested in me doing another book. So one day I just sat there and took a chapter of Dogen and tried to do that with it, and it came out not so bad. And I thought, well, this might be something, because Dogen is, just for people who don't know, he's a 13th century Japanese Buddhist philosopher and monk and writer who wrote some really, I think, really, really good stuff about Zen practice and Zen philosophy. And there's a certain interest in Dogen these days among Western people, even including people who are not necessarily interested in Buddhism. But most of the time when you try to read Dogen in translation, it's just a nightmare because it's really, really difficult. Even the best translations tend to be just really, really hard going just to read them, just to actually sit there and just try to make sense of what the guy is saying. And I thought, well, I could maybe eliminate a lot of what makes it difficult because I don't have to be true necessarily to exactly what the original says. If I do it in this format, I can just kind of give an impression of what it says and try to put it in my own words.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a step back and maybe try to fill in some listeners who may not be familiar with Zen Buddhism or sure. Dogen or yourself. Why would you want to write a book about this philosopher from Japan who lived hundreds of years ago?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, just because a philosophy is old and foreign doesn't mean it's bad. So, you know, there's one thing. But I first got interested in Zen when I was a college student. I was about 18 or 19, and I went. I took a class called Zen Buddhism at Kent State University. I was then the bass player for a hardcore punk band called Zero Defects. And I'd gotten into hardcore punk because at the time, it seemed I was really interested in truth. I wanted to know what's true about the world that I am living in. That was my main focus. And I was very interested in rock music, too, and in performing. And there was no true rock music anymore, as far as I was concerned. It was all, you know, horrible. And then the punk rock movement came out, and I thought, oh, this is something true. And I got into it. Then when I discovered Zen, what I felt was, oh my God, this is like everything in punk rock, but taken to its logical conclusion of just tearing down everything and trying to get at the direct experience of what is true without any sort of intermediary telling you what to expect or what to do. So I started getting very deeply into Zen practice. Ended up moving to Japan, not for Zen, but to get a job. Worked as an English teacher for a year. And then I moved to Tokyo to get a job I wasn't in Tokyo at first, I was in another city. And to get a job in a film production company that made cheap Japanese monster movies, which I loved. And I loved the company and I loved their stuff. And being in Tokyo, I got introduced to a Zen teacher named Gudo Nishijima, who his thing for 50-odd years or more, I guess, toward the end, he passed away a few years ago, was studying Dogen. He just studied Dogen like crazy. He didn't have any specific degrees or anything that sort of made him a Dogen expert in the eyes of academia or anything, but he'd studied Dogen deeply and everything written about Dogen since he was a teenager, and he wrote what was at the time the only complete translation of Dogen's gigantic masterwork called Shobo Genzo. And so through him I got more interested in Dogen and understanding Dogen, and I've just been trying to kind of make what I understood from Dogen available to the wider world, because I think it's useful stuff.
Mm-hmm. In a way, it's the last two books, because they focus on Dogen, I wanted to sort of start off our talk about them. But really, these last two books are not all that much of a departure from your, what I might call your Zen, your personal Zen narrative. You've got several books that came before this, mm-hmm. and I'd love it if you walked us through a little bit about the ideas behind those.
Okay, I'll try my best. The first book that I ever published was Hardcore Zen. It came out in, I guess, 2003, end of 2003. And it, you know, when you write a book, you never know if it's going to be your last one. So I tried to pack everything into this one book. But the weird thing about it is during the writing of that book, I thought I was writing an unpublishable book because it combined Zen Buddhism and punk rock mm-hmm. and Japanese monster movies right. into a single narrative. And I thought there's absolutely no audience for this. The Zen people are not going to like the punk rock or monster movie stuff, and the punk rock people are going to hate the Zen stuff, although they might like the monster movie stuff. And the monster movie stuff, only, you know, those people only want to hear about monster movies. They don't want to hear anything else. So I thought I was writing this unpublishable book, but it got published. And then people started wanting another one. So the second book, Sit Down and Shut Up, followed by, God, I think it was like 5 years before I felt inclined to write another book. Uh-huh. And that one is actually the first book I did about Dogen. So that book is actually related to these last two in that it's an attempt to distill Dogen's basic philosophical stuff into a single sort of book that normal people can read.
Right.
And it's kind of interwoven with a narrative about reuniting the first, that hardcore punk band that I'd been a part of in the 80s. So there's a little bit of a storyline about that, but it's mostly Dogen. And what's the next one? I guess the next one would be Zen Wrapped in Karma, Dipped in Chocolate, which is, I think, the most important book I've written so far, and it's the one that nobody buys.
Why?
because it's about what Zen practice is in real life, and I really tried to break down all of the BS that's out there about what a spiritual teacher is and what it's like to be one of those, because I was going around and doing this a lot, and I realized, oh, I'm also a human being with a lot of whatever a human beings bring to any line of work they choose to go into. And I wanted to humanize it, and I wanted to kind of give give the real deal on what it's like to do this sort of work and cut through some of the illusions. It's the only one I haven't done an audiobook on, because I don't want to read that book again.
Why? Because does it feel heavier to you? Is it because it feels more important?
Yeah, well, it's because it's very personal. Basically, it's a chronicle of the year 2007 as I experienced it, in which my mother died, my grandmother died, my then wife left me, and I lost my job. And I was running around the country trying to teach people about Zen Buddhism and how to be, you know, how to be all Zen and everything or whatever.
Sure.
The stuff going on in the background. That I wasn't really telling anybody was happening, because it's not really appropriate to talk about that when you're supposed to be talking about Zen to people.
Right. I did want to say how much I enjoyed both Don't Be a Jerk and It Came from Beyond Zen, which is a sort of a two-volume translation of Dogen's Shobogenzo, if I've pronounced that correctly.
Close enough. Shobogenzo.
Okay, thank you. But you know what? It's not just a translation at all. It has actually a lot in common with your previous books, and that it is about several things at the same time.
Yeah.
Because you're walking us through not just what's in the text and the thinking behind it, but you're also doing your own translation while comparing your work to translators of the same text who've come before you.
Yeah.
And you're also throwing in your own narrative that traces kind of your dawning understanding of the material. And it seems almost like these are travelogues more than translations.
Yeah, I think so. I don't even like to use the word translation to describe those books, because I feel like I've gone so far in another direction that they don't really qualify as a translation. I guess they're a kind of translation. But it's kind of the book I would have wanted to read about Dogen, because if I'm reading Dogen in translation, I also kind of want to know, well, what is this guy not telling us? You know, the person, the author of the translation, what are they not telling us, or why are they choosing these words and phrases instead of other words and phrases, and what's the deal here? So I try to kind of, it's kind of like when you do a math problem and the math teacher says, show your work, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to show my work. I'm trying to say, well, this is how I arrived at this version of the text. And then trying to give, you know, a lot of what makes Dogen hard is not that important. It's you know, a lot of it is knowing. He'll make references to things that his initial audience would have known about, but the audience that we are today, even if you're Japanese, you don't know what these things are. So I think I've tried to find kind of reasonable equivalents to those things or just take that stuff out if it doesn't seem relevant, and try to get to the heart of the matter and get to what he's really trying to say through all of that. And I have to kind of make assumptions. You know, I'm kind of assuming I'm correct. But actually what I've done in the book is something I've never seen any translator of anything, let alone Dogen, do, which is I say, well, here's parts where I might be incorrect. You know, I might be wrong mm-hmm. about this one, because I really, honestly, I don't know what he's saying here.
It strikes me, too, that every time you get to a place like that, you sort of double down and go back and say, well, here's what this other translator said about this, and here's what the Shasta Abbey translation says. And then you almost seem to take special care with those parts of the text that are harder to get to. And so then you bring almost another level, really, of unpacking the material to that.
Yeah, thanks. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say, well, here it is, and yeah. I mean, there are some parts where it's just unclear. And what was kind of fascinating to me in the process was that, because I was sitting here at the same table as I'm sitting talking to you at, with all these translations of Dogen in the original Japanese text and all these things sitting in front of me. And I could find lines, individual lines, not an overall pattern or anything, but individual lines where all of the translations disagreed. Like, most of the translations of Dogen agree, you know, about 75 to 80%. You're going to get pretty much the same thing from any translation. But there's certain parts where you go, okay, in this line I'm getting six completely different things with, depending on which translator. And then I go back and read the original and I can go, oh, I see. You know, I can see what they're dealing with and why they might have just been like baffled by it and gone, well, I got to put in something here. You know?
Yeah, that's definitely.
I feel like a lot of times I'm looking at the work of somebody who's just like, well, you know, there's a sentence here, I don't know what it means, so I'm just going to put something in.
Can you sort of distill what it is about Dogen that makes him so revered by Zen Buddhists?
I've been thinking about this lately, and I don't know if I even like Dogen or if I even like Zen. It's a lot of things I find more appealing, you know, in a visceral sort of way, that are more exciting or more, you know, I don't know, more what I'd like to believe or whatever. But when I look at Dogen's writings, I find that he is painfully realistic. I've been thinking about this lately, and I feel like I don't even know if I actually like Dogen or like Zen. I mean, there's a lot of other things I find more appealing in sort of a visceral way, sort of an immediate way. I'd probably, if I had my, you know, my druthers, whatever that means, I'd probably get into, I don't know, something much more colorful, you know, something much
like
more.
Like what?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I like the old Hindu temples with their blue four-limbed, you know, four-armed gods and things like that. You know, all that sort of acid trippy stuff. I actually really enjoy a lot more. I'm always getting into weird debates on Twitter and stuff with people who advocate psychedelic drugs as a method for discovering reality. And one thing I would love to make clear to those people that I've tried to is I would love it if an acid trip would make reality clearer. That'd be great, you know.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. It just doesn't, you know. And that's the problem for me. And I have to be realistic. And what I like about Dogen is he's really, really realistic. And he deconstructs everything. You can find yourself questioning, you know, obvious statements like I ate a donut yesterday, or I didn't, but you know, you can go, well, that's, oh, did I eat a donut yesterday? You know, after reading Dogen for a while, you can kind of start wondering. And he points out he's very contradictory. So he'll contradict himself all the time, which makes you kind of look at expression in a way, but he doesn't, he's not crazy, you know, When I first looked at Dogen, I think he just sounded crazy to me.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think he's crazy.
Right. So these people on social media who are trying to have a conversation about how psychedelic drugs can open your mind, where do you suppose that comes from? And why is it why do your followers want to have that conversation, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I don't know if some of these people are even people who know my work at all, but I think they come out of the woodwork as soon as you insult psychedelics.
And did you insult psychedelics?
Yeah, and I think people take it personally. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think, looking back on my life and trying to trace my history, that my first forays into LSD and my first forays into Zen came at about the same time. I'm not exactly sure anymore. Mm-hmm. But it was really clear to me after doing acid a few times that this wasn't living up to the hype. And I'm amazed the hype still exists.
Yeah.
So I can kind of see, because it, you know, whacks your head, you know, in a bizarre way, and you start to see all kinds of things that don't make sense and have funny ideas and stuff. But there's no context for it. It's just kind of,
right.
You're just kind of ripped out of ordinary consciousness, I suppose, and put in kind of crazy land, and you don't know what to do about it, and then you come back to ordinary consciousness and go, wow, I must have had an enlightenment experience.
Right.
Well, yeah, sure you did.
I think that's right. Yeah. And I think if you have not spent a lot of time in meditation in the first place, things that psychedelics do to your brain might seem to ape that experience as far as it really is from it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's something to be said that there's this idea in Buddhist stuff about enlightenment experiences, and maybe some of the experiences you have on psychedelics have some vague relationship to that, but they're taken so far out of context that you can't make sense of the experience. And so, and when you do a meditation practice, you work on it very slowly over time, and you kind of move through the different, I don't even like talking about levels, but let's say we can talk about levels. You move through different layers of experience, let's say, and you can kind of make sense of them because they come slowly enough that you have a chance to get used to each one as it unfolds.
Yeah.
Whereas the LSD experience or the psychedelic experience just kind of shoots you right into the center of it and then pulls you out 3 hours later.
Right.
And you go, what the hell just happened? You know.
You've talked a lot in your previous books and in the last two about your love of playing music. Can you talk a little bit about how that might make more sense to you as far as finding things that are true to you, maybe more than psychedelic drugs?
I don't know. There's something, my teacher, the guy who ordained me, Gudo Nishijima, he used to say that the first place that he encountered what he called the balanced state, which he talks about in terms of Zen, was as a track runner. I guess in high school and maybe even into his university days, he was a pretty good track runner. And he had this experience of openness where, you know, time sort of stands still and you're just doing this thing in a very pure way. Well, when I heard him talk about that, I could relate it to some of the experiences I had as a musician, if you can call a punk rock bass player a musician. But there are times when everything is just kind of connecting up, and they don't happen that often. But I've seen it happen while playing music, to where everything just sort of falls away, and you're in this whole, you're still experiencing the world in more or less a normal way. You still know where your hands and feet are and your head is. You know, it's not like an LSD experience exactly in that way. But but there's something going on where the connection or the barrier you thought existed between yourself and the rest of the band and the audience just kind of goes away. You know, and it's not like you can read people's minds or anything weird like that, but it's all fusing together in this very open way. And what Nishijima Roshi would say was that Zazen practice allows you to experience that same thing more easily, which doesn't mean it's easy, but you don't have to lug the amplifiers up the stairs in the club and deal with the promoters and you know, all the drugs and things that are around and all that stuff to get this same, at least an opportunity to dive into that same sort of experience of just wholeness. And I think that's where the connection is for me.
So what is it about your work right now that makes you question how much you like it right now?
I've just been thinking about it because I think people perceive me as a guy who really loves Dogen. And I guess in a sense, that's true. But I'm also annoyed by him, or he says things that I wish weren't true, but then I examine them and go, yeah, I think he's right. Uh-huh. You know?
Can you give me an example?
Well, let's try this one. A lot of people get into Buddhist practice because there are a lot of Westerners, because they hear about reincarnation and they love the idea of reincarnation and they want to get reincarnated.
Right.
It sounds like a more rational or believable version of life after death. And Dogen questions that. He seems to. I wrote a whole chapter about this in Don't Be a Jerk. My guess is he believed in something that we might classify as reincarnation, but the version of it he seems to advocate is nothing like what people imagine. It have anything to do with life after death.
Right.
I mean, he even says, firewood turns to ash, it does not return to being firewood again. In the same way, once a person dies, they do not return to life again.
Right.
Which puts the damper on most people's ideas of reincarnation. Yet he seems to also hold out the possibility that we are intimately connected with something bigger that doesn't die, and that we are kind of a manifestation of that something. So right. we die, but that doesn't, and at some level we are the same as that something, but not in the way most of us think of as ourselves. So you know, I'd love to believe in somebody who said I was going to be, you know, I was going to live forever and be reincarnated or whatever.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, I would love to be able to believe that, but there just doesn't seem to be any good evidence or any good reason to believe that. But this other idea that Dogen puts forward, that one of the things he says is we are the eyes and ears with which it experiences itself. And this it, I kind of think is a little bit like the early Christians' concept of God, was this idea of not a guy on a golden throne up in the sky, but more of a something that is the sum total of everything, and that we are a manifestation of that. Which I like that idea, because it still gives me a chance to continue forever, but I have to kind of give up this idea that I am going to continue forever. I just sound weirdo now, I think.
Yeah. So, given that you are where you are right now, just finishing these two books that are sort of directly examining Dogen's work, what, if anything, are you writing right now? What are you doing in your music life? How are you spending your time now?
That's a good question. I'm going through major writer's block. If you want an honest answer, I'm in that phase that a lot of people do in the process of writing, where I hate everything that I write as soon as it's written. I just go, oh, this is garbage. I can't make other people read this. So
I think that's normal, if annoying.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of I kind of realize at this point that it's part of the process, but I have an idea for a book, and I want to kind of make an honest appraisal of what Zen is, Zen Buddhism as a whole, and what it means and how it can be useful to people in the contemporary world. And I want to make this very honest piece of writing about that. In other places, what else am I doing? I've been actually working on, it's totally unrelated to Zen, probably working on a possible TV pilot that me and a friend of mine hatched this idea for, and we're going to see where it goes. So I've been spending some time doing that, which is nice because it sort of gets you out of the, you know, one of the things that helps with writing is to get out of the gears that you're in, do something else for a while.
No, definitely.
So that's been interesting. The band is we're playing a show in July. We've been doing about one or two shows a year for the past 10 years, this hardcore band that I'm in.
Sure.
So I do that, and I'll be going to Europe in, I guess, May and June of this year, and giving talks and leading retreats and so forth. And then I just opened this place in LA called the Angel City Zen Center, because the Los Angeles Zen Center name was already taken. So Angel City just means Los Angeles. And we're working on making that a thing. I'm hoping more people, not a lot of people show up at this place, but I'm hoping to get more folks in there, because I think actually doing the practice is important. You know, you can read about it, and that's interesting. I'm glad there's an audience out there to read about it, because it helps me make a living. But I want more people to actually do it, because then they'll see it in a different way. Because it's one thing to read about it, and it's another thing to do it. It's just like anything else.
So is that why a person in your position? I'm speaking of your position as a priest, maybe more so than as a writer. Is that why you travel? Is that why you're going to Europe, to get more people to actually sit?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I found that there are people. It started out with invitations. I guess it was 2009 when I first went over, and people would invite me over there because there were translations. There was a Finnish translation of Hardcore Zen, and the first place I ended up going was Finland, of all places, and speaking to some people there who were interested in it. So usually what I'm doing in Europe is, I think most of the time I'm leading retreats and occasionally giving a public talk, but usually I'm leading a retreat with a group of people who are interested in dedicating themselves to Zen practice for a period of several days to a week at a time, and I'm kind of, I don't know what my role in that is. It's sort of a facilitator, sort of a big brother kind of thing. The fun, you know, you use the word priest, and that's, people call what they call what I do a Zen priest or Zen monk, but the function of the monk or priest in Zen is so different. I mean, there is a certain amount of, you know, wearing black robes and offering incense and doing things that Catholic priests do. But the idea is that I'm a fellow practitioner with a bit more practice under my belt than anybody else in the room. And in that way, I can help other people with their particular difficulties they might be having doing the practice. And so that's what I try to do as I travel. I just try to help people get through it.
What does that look like, though? Are you sitting next to people in a zendo and you're showing them actually how to do the practice? Or are you delivering short talks that tells them sort of what to expect? How does it work?
A bit of both. Teaching somebody how to do Zazen takes about 5 minutes. I can do it quicker than that if I have to, because the physical practice, the process is really, really simple. You're just basically sitting still. And what comes out of that sitting still over long periods of time is something that's what I'm trying to work with. So, you know, I'll do the initial teaching and then I'll sit a few rounds with them. And then what I usually end up doing on most of these retreats is I go off into a little room, and then people come to me one one by one, and we talk about their practice. And I'll, you know, depending on how many people are there, it can take a few days to get through everybody like this, because I don't like to make these. Some people have strict time limits on these sort of sessions where they'll give somebody, you know, you've got 2 minutes to say your piece and then you're out. I don't like to do it that way. And I'm not the only one who doesn't do it that way. There are other people who approach it the way I do. So I do that, and then I give talks. And at the talks, I like to make them conversational. So I say my piece and then try to get the people in the room to kind of respond to me and tell me what they're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you too about Angel City. Mm-hmm. And I know that you crowdsourced a lot of the funding to bring it to fruition. I wonder if, is that sort of standard practice nowadays when you're trying to open a new center, or did you just break new ground in Buddhism by gathering funding that way?
It's a good question. Now that you mention it, I don't know of any other Zen centers that were crowdsourced. I just knew people in the film business, particularly my friend Piruz is an indie filmmaker, and I've been in a bunch of his movies, and that's another thing I'm going to do. I'm going to do another Piruz movie later this year. Nobody ever sees these films, or they play at a couple festivals and then kind of disappear, but I think they're great films, and I'm hoping things change. But anyway, so I knew how to do that, and I said, well, maybe we'll apply that to this. I don't know. It seems like a lot of people come to it in different ways. A lot of times you're part of a larger institution that wants to establish temples, but I'm not part of a larger institution. I'm independent. You know, my teacher broke away from the larger institution called Soto Shu. You know, he was ordained through, he was actually ordained by the guy who at the time was the head of the Soto Shu, which is a large sort of Vatican-like organization in Japan with loads of temples, and they oversee it and all the rest. But he didn't like the way they did things, and so he broke off from them and became independent. And so I didn't, because of that, I didn't have any resources from him to back me up or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't have and even though I'm in Los Angeles, we've yet to find some rich, you know, movie star or something who wants to give us a lot of money. So we
keep digging.
Yeah, you know, it might happen. There were a few people along those lines who were sort of buzzing around the place at one point, and now they've all disappeared. So I guess I'm not appealing to that sort of a person.
Well, we live in interesting times.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you've been in at least one film, and you're working on another. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I've been in a bunch of films. This guy I know, Piruz Kalea, he makes these low-budget films that actually look very good. I say low-budget and people expect them to look like trash, but he knows how to get people to work for free or cheap, and he always has a good cinematographer and a good editor, and these things look very slick and professional. The first one I did for him was called Shoplifting from American Apparel, which was based on a very short novel called by the same name. Mm-hmm. And then he did a documentary about me called Brad Warner's Hardcore Zen, which I liked. I thought he did a good, honest portrayal of me. It's not all candy and flowers. It's not all nice, but I think that's the way I wanted it. And then I did, the best one I did from him is called Zombie Bounty Hunter MD, which I thought was a great film because it's about these people who come across a real attack, infestation of zombies who are attacking people and killing them. But they're sort of the mindset that a lot of people have in this day and age, where they just want to film it and put it up on YouTube and make themselves famous. So instead of doing something productive against these zombies and working on the problem, they just take the problem and make it bigger so that they can become more famous. It's a metaphor for the way a lot of things are done today, especially a lot of stuff in politics nowadays seems to be people jumping on problems and exacerbating them rather than trying to work and fix them. And it's kind of sad to see everything turned into a big reality show. Reality has become a reality show. It's kind of scary.
Yeah, agreed. And I hate to end on that note. Well, and let me give you something. Advice for writers.
Advice for writers. That's an interesting one. You know, I think, well, the interesting thing for me about Hardcore Zen getting published was I had spent, God, I started in high school trying to write short stories and a little after high school started submitting stories to magazines and things and trying to get published. So, and all was failing. So I'd done it a lot, and about 5 years before Hardcore Zen came out, I was in this process of getting really, really serious about it, and I wrote 3 complete novels and sent them into publishers, and I got some publishers who were interested in them. I had one ask me for a major rewrite before they turned down the book. It, you know, kind of typical things that often happen with writers. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, my teachers had said, why don't you write a book about Zen Buddhism? And I thought I couldn't do it, but I'd run out of ideas for novels. So I just dedicated myself to writing a book about my life in Zen Buddhism, more as an exercise to see if I could turn that into a book than any. So I had no idea of publishing this thing. So I didn't care at all what anyone else thought of it. I wasn't trying to anticipate what a potential reader might think of the thing and, you know, tailor it to a market tastes or anything else in the least. And that was the book that got published.
Yeah.
So I think there's something to be said for that approach, is to just not worry. People write. I know I wrote things that I thought would be publishable. You know, I didn't try to write dishonestly, but I kind of looked at what the market was and what was out there and said, well, sure, I can write one of these.
Yeah.
And for Hardcore Zen, there wasn't one of those. There wasn't any precedent I could look to for what I was writing. I mean, at least it was still a sort of standard book, you know, with paragraphs and everything like that. I wasn't trying to completely break the mold, but, you know, do something where I didn't care.
That's great. That's great advice. Do something where you just don't care.
Yeah, I mean, you're just trying to please yourself. And I think if you can please yourself in your own writing, then other people will respond to that. And if not, they're going to see that, you know.
That's great. That's beautiful. Brad, I've really enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview that Kim McQueen conducted with the author Brad Warner. His new book is It Came From Beyond Zen, published by New World Library. You can learn more about his work at his website, hardcorezen.info. I'm going to paraphrase a line from Brad Warner's new book, It Came From Beyond Zen. The line comes from the 13th century Japanese Zen master Eihi Dogen. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Dogen is the person they were talking about during the interview. It is translated and explained by Brad in his book. I'm actually paraphrasing the line because I forgot to ask if I could use the original. So here's my paraphrase. Treating people right falls into 4 main behaviors: free giving, kind speech, being helpful, and cooperation. If you'd like to read more analysis about these 4 ways to treat people, you'll want to turn to Brad's book. But if you can, in the coming week, take in the basic premise behind these suggestions and use them in your work. Somehow try to infuse your writing or maybe the actions of a character with the ideas of free giving, kind speech, helpfulness, and cooperation. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. We're finishing up about 15, 20 minutes early, so I'm going to put some music on for you, and then at 5 o'clock, you'll have Democracy Now! I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.